I next met with Dr. Francine Foss to discuss one of the most complex parts of oncology, the T-cell lymphomas, and to bring things into clinical perspective, she presented a patient from her practice.
So this patient is a 34-year-old woman who had a history of patch and plaque mycosis fungoides and erythroderma, actually. And she presented originally in Puerto Rico when she was diagnosed there. And she was treated with CHOP for 6 cycles. Like many patients with CTCL who get CHOP, she had a very nice clinical response, but a very quick relapse, less than 6 months after she completed her therapy. So when she presented to me, she had, in addition to extensive plaques and areas of erythema, she also had multiple tumors, and some of these were as big as 5 centimeters diameter, and they were on her trunk as well as her interior chest wall. And I think this case brings up an interesting point with mycosis fungoides, which is the whole issue of how the disease evolves. So many patients present with patches and plaques, and for a lot of those patients, they can go on for a very long time without progressing. But when you do see a progression to tumor stage disease, I think you need to be concerned about that patient because that patient is declaring themselves as having a more aggressive clinical course. And I think one of the important things is really to go back and re-biopsy the patient. What we're really looking for there is whether or not there's a change in the histology, whether or not this has evolved into what we call a large cell transformation, which is similar to the Richter's transformation in CLL, because that really portends a much different prognosis for the patient. So the first step in a patient like this would be to get a biopsy just to kind of confirm that you're dealing with tumor stage MF without a histologic transformation.
And did you get a biopsy on her?
So we did get a biopsy, and fortunately, this lady did not transform at this point in time.
So what were the options that you were thinking through, both on and off study at that point?
Well, this lady obviously already had CHOP, so she's already had multi-agent chemotherapy, and she's relapsed with fairly aggressive clinical disease. At this point, there would be a number of options, and I think that what you pick really depends on what your long-term plan is for this patient. So obviously, one could give more multi-agent cytotoxic chemotherapy, and regimens like gemcitabine and Doxil are useful here. But also, there have been a couple of new drugs that have been approved recently for CTCL, and for many of these drugs, if you actually look at many of these drugs, about a third of patients respond to these drugs, and they're a lot less toxic and not bone marrow suppressive. So I think it would certainly be reasonable to consider one of those single-agent therapies in this case. In terms of my big picture for this lady, she's a young woman, and she's obviously got refractory disease, aggressive disease. And so now we're starting to think more and more about the use of allogeneic stem cell transplant in this setting. But we know from the studies that we've done and the data that's very limited that patients really need to be in remission. And so we need to give effective salvage chemotherapy of one sort or another to get this lady into remission. And then I would consider moving her on to a transplant.
When you're talking about the new agents, you're talking about pralatrexate and romidepsin?
Well, romidepsin is FDA approved for CTCL, and pralatrexate is FDA approved for PTCL, but there were transformed MF patients in that study. There also was a study that was presented by Dr. Horowitz at ASH this year, which involved over 50 patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma of all stages. And that study showed a very high response rate for pralatrexate. In that study, the pralatrexate was given at a slightly lower dose and on a different schedule than in the PTCL study. But nevertheless, it proved to be a very active agent in that setting.
But when you were talking about two agents, were those the two?
Denileukin diftatox that one could consider would be, certainly one could consider Denileukin diftatox, which is an agent that's been out there for a number of years. And like I said, if you were going to do single agent chemotherapy, both gemcitabine and Doxil have shown significant activity in this setting.
So what happened with this lady?
What we decided to do with this lady is we did give this lady romidepsin, and she had a partial response for a couple of months, and then her disease recurred. She had Denileukin diftatox and didn't have any response to that. We had some difficulty with the pralatrexate because of insurance issues, and so we moved her on to gemcitabine. She actually did very well with the gemcitabine and now is in a very good PR, if not a CR.
Where do you see things heading in the future for her?
Well, what we decided to do, since this lady does have an unrelated donor that's HLA matched, is to move forward with an allogeneic stem cell transplant. There are a couple of issues here, one of which is when you get a patient in remission, how do you keep them in remission? There really aren't any studies addressing maintenance therapy, although certainly when we give agents like romidepsin and even bexarotene, which is oral, we continue those therapies until patients relapse. And likewise with vorinostat, all of those trials involved continuous therapy. So given that it takes a couple of months to identify the unrelated donor and do all the work that's necessary, we really, at this point in time, are looking at trying to maintain the remission in this lady. And in this case, we decided to go ahead and give her vorinostat because it's an agent that's relatively well tolerated in this setting. And also, we're going to give her some radiation to her skin just to consolidate her response before the transplant.
So you see responses to vorinostat in people who've previously gotten romidepsin and vice versa?
Well, that's an interesting question, and we really have very little data addressing that issue. But we did have a couple of patients who had seen vorinostat who received romidepsin, and there was a response in one of those patients. And so I think it certainly is possible. It's an issue that's undergoing further study. And as you know, there are other HDAC inhibitors out there as well, like belinostat that's in clinical trials. And in that trial, there are people that have been exposed to other HDAC inhibitors who are being enrolled.
Do we know anything about who actually takes care of these patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphomas?
Well, CTCL is still a schizophrenic disease because it's really split between the dermatologists and the medical oncologists. And traditionally, the dermatologists would hold on to the patients. But now that we've got a number of systemic options available, we find that the dermatologists are referring them to medical oncology sooner. And in fact, it's our recommendation that patients get referred to see us at diagnosis, even if it's a very early stage patient and the dermatologist may be managing that patient for the first year or so or even longer. I think it's helpful to at least get a medical oncologist involved.
You know, when you ask medical oncologists, they say, I don't have any patients in my practice. Do you think that most of these people are finding their way into tertiary centers?
What happens is that many of these patients, if they go online, and all of our patients are internet savvy now, they're finding the Cutaneous Lymphoma Foundation website, which lists centers of excellence for CTCL. And these are designated centers of excellence because they have multimodality therapy available. So they do have dermatologists and medical oncologists. And many of these centers are serving as a second opinion or referral centers for patients from the community. And physicians are working together to try to keep these patients in the community if possible, but to make sure that they get state-of-the-art care.
What do patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma or mycosis fungoides die of when they do die?
Well, it's interesting because many of these patients don't actually die of their disease. And that's kind of difficult to convince patients of when they come in with a diagnosis. If you look at the early stage patients, the limited patch plaque patients, many of those patients have a survival that's pretty much the same as a normal population, age-matched population. When they have more extensive plaque stage disease, and certainly when they have tumor stage disease, their survival is impacted by their disease. But one of the major issues for these patients is infection because their skin is really compromised, and also their immune system is compromised by their disease. Many of these patients actually die from infection.
In a way, I'm trying to kind of visualize it as a massive skin infection or resistant to antibiotic thing or what?
Well, what we've learned is by doing studies of immune function and doing very sophisticated analyses like spectrotype analysis to look at the T-cell diversity in these patients, we find that their immune system is compromised. In other words, they're not generating a normal T-cell response to antigens. And so therefore, they're functionally like patients who are immune suppressed from other things like graft-versus-host disease. And so even in early stage disease, a patient may not be able to mount a response to a common bacterial infection like staph or strep that colonizes all of us all the time.
Can you go through the therapies that you just reviewed in terms of particularly the side effects and toxicities and how you sequence them and sort of individualize, I guess, beginning with romidepsin, which she got, and pralatrexate, Denileukin, and everything that you just talked about. How did she do, incidentally, on the romidepsin?
Well, on the romidepsin, she initially had a very nice partial response. Her tumor started to recede, but then there was a response plateau. And then after about 4 months, additional tumors start to appear.
How about in terms of side effects and toxicity?
The side effects of romidepsin are really pretty predictable since the drug is given IV once a week. Generally speaking, patients will have some nausea. Some patients have constitutional side effects like fatigue. But pretty much that goes away after a couple of days.
Anything else?
Well, we know that romidepsin can prolong the QTC interval. And so one of the things that we did in the clinical trial is that we got EKGs, three EKGs prior to the antiemetic, EKGs after the antiemetic, EKGs before the romidepsin, after the romidepsin, et cetera, et cetera.
A little cardiology unit there.
And we had a cardiology consultant who was working with us on that study because the FDA basically mandated that. And we also, in prior studies, looked at echocardiogram as well as CPK and changes in cardiac enzymes. And we basically found that what we see in many patients is a prolongation of the QTC that's transient. And for many patients, patients who don't have the hereditary QTC syndrome, that's asymptomatic and it has no clinical consequences. And so even though we see it, we don't really worry too much about it. But what we do, though, and we know that this is helpful, is that we do make sure that patients have adequate supplementation for potassium and magnesium. And for some patients, that means getting an infusion immediately prior to their romidepsin.
What about her?
This lady actually did very well. She didn't require any extra medications, and she had no adverse events from the romidepsin.
What about pralatrexate?
Pralatrexate is a methotrexate derivative, and so pralatrexate is associated with some of the same side effects as methotrexate, namely that patients can get mucositis, and thrombocytopenia is the other side effect. But the one that's most troubling really is the mucositis. And what we need to do with pralatrexate is that we need to remember to give the vitamin supplementation ahead of time, which is B12 and folic acid. We need to remember to do that a week ahead of time. So if we're even thinking about pralatrexate for a patient, we'll go ahead and give them an injection of vitamin B12 and start them on folic acid.
You mentioned denileukin diflitox. Anything new with that? It kind of scares a lot of people.
Denileukin diflitox, as you know, is an IL-2 fusion protein. And in the very first trials that we did with denileukin diflitox, we didn't use steroid premedication. And so consequently, we had a lot of patients who developed infusion reactions. We subsequently have completed a placebo-controlled trial, an international placebo-controlled trial that was randomized between a placebo and two arms of denileukin diflitox. And that study showed that the response rate in that group of patients that was somewhat earlier stage was in the range of about 47%. It was higher than in our previous trial where it was 30%. And the toxicities were pretty much the same in terms of the infusion reactions and also the vascular leak syndrome that occurs in about 20 to 25% of patients. Now, in practice, when we use denileukin diflitox, just about everybody will give steroid premedication, which we were not allowed to do on the clinical trial. And so, therefore, the incidence of infusion-related reactions has gone down significantly. But what I find in practice is that the vascular leak is really still out there and it still needs to be dealt with. And what I generally do is I counsel patients about it so that they know to look out for it. I pretty much expect to see it in the first cycle. And I think it's pretty much manageable in most of our patients. Some of the patients will need a little bit of diuresis and some of the patients might need some IV fluid, but most of the patients will get through it.
What exactly do you see clinically?
Well, most patients will come in and note that they have diffuse muscle aches, they feel fatigued, and they're putting on weight. And some of them will actually have pitting edema. Some of them can put on up to 10 to 15 pounds of fluid, but I would say that's unusual. Most of the patients come in with 5 or 10 pounds of extra weight.
So how do you go about deciding what sequence to use? In this case, you chose romidepsin. Why did you choose it?
Well, I think this patient is a little bit different than the de novo patient that I would be managing from the beginning. Because generally speaking, with a patient with extensive patch plaque disease, my first treatment would be some skin-based therapy, along with one of the oral therapies, which would either be bexarotene or vorinostat.
So she never got that?
So she went directly to chemotherapy.
I saw that in the history, and I kind of almost assumed she'd had prior local therapy, so she didn't.
Well, it's interesting because I think that physicians who are not that familiar with CTCL might think about this the way they think about other lymphomas and just jump right to CHOP as a reflex reaction.
When you talk about CTCL, that includes mycosis fungoides and what else?
Well, the term CTCL is really, I think, a term that's falling out of favor because with the new WHO classification and the EORTC classification for T-cell lymphomas of the skin, we're now actually subdividing the term CTCL, which includes a number of different entities, into the specific diseases. And so we used to use CTCL to mean mycosis fungoides and the Sézary syndrome. But we have other cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, such as the CD30-positive lymphomas of the skin. We have paniculitic T-cell lymphoma. We have PTCL, NOS that presents in the skin. We have NK lymphomas presenting in the skin. And so when we use this term CTCL, it really doesn't mean anything anymore. And I'm encouraging physicians to use the specific terminology for the specific disease. And you'll notice that path reports now are starting to follow along with that as well.
But for all of these diseases, is the usual first approach local?
For the mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome patients, all of these patients do require some kind of cutaneous-based therapy, again, because the disease is presenting on their skin. In the context of Sézary syndrome, many of those patients will get photopheresis because we know that photopheresis can help about 40% of those patients and is associated with very little toxicity. So it would always be a skin-directed therapy along with some kind of a systemic therapy. And those systemic therapies are oftentimes these oral agents.
And again, side effects, toxicity with those agents like bexarotene?
Well, bexarotene is somewhat problematic in terms of management because it does increase your lipids and your cholesterol, and it does lower your thyroid function. And the tricky thing there is that you have to remember not to follow the TSH because we know that the TSH will be suppressed in all patients. And so what you really need to do is follow the free T4. And just about every patient on therapeutic doses of bexarotene will require Synthroid to replace their thyroid, and many of them required lipid-lowering agents as well.
Now, you mentioned that you did a biopsy on her. What if it had shown something else? You know, what else could it have shown that would have changed your approach?
If it had shown a large cell transformation, then I probably would have been more aggressive. If you look at our clinical trials with the agents that are approved with denileukin diftatox, with bexarotene, and with romidepsin, we excluded patients with large cell transformation. The only study that really addressed those patients was the pralatrexate study, where there were patients with large cell transformation in that study. And so my choice for her would probably have been pralatrexate if I could have gotten it, or perhaps a more aggressive chemotherapy approach. And again, the reason for that is the outcome with large cell transformation is very different than the outcome for patients with tumor stage disease.
How do you explain the taxonomy of T-cell lymphoma disease in general to, like, you know, a medical student? Every time I try to, you know, find out about that, I find myself getting more and more confused. Any way you can simplify it?
Well, I think that the whole issue with T-cell lymphoma is getting more confusing rather than more basic. And the reason for that is that the classification system has now identified a number of different entities, and there are some provisional entities now. And even with the most recent iteration of the classification system, we're now taking ALK-positive and ALK-negative anaplastic large cell lymphoma, and we're breaking them into separate groups as well. We've also taken paniculitic T-cell lymphoma, and we've divided that into the alpha-beta versus the gamma-delta. And the gamma-delta is now cutaneous gamma-delta T-cell lymphoma. So I think it's getting more confusing for us and certainly is getting more confusing for everybody else as well. But I think that the good news is that we are now starting to identify some molecular features that we can use to characterize some of these diseases.
Now, you mentioned CD30. Maybe you can comment on the SGN compound. And is there any thought about using that in cutaneous disease? I know it was just, maybe you can talk about what's been reported up to now.
Well, the SGN35 is, I think, a very exciting agent, again, targeting CD30. We had done prior trials just with the CD30 antibody that showed some response, but again, you wouldn't expect a naked antibody to do much. And so this is actually an antibody conjugated with a toxin. And this is actually a very active agent. If you look at the recent data that was presented at ASH in anaplastic large cell lymphoma, there was a very high response rate, and a number of those patients had already had two prior therapies. And so again, it's a refractory group of patients. I would say an astounding response rate in that setting. So now we're looking at moving it up front, looking at combining it with CHOP as a first-line approach for patients with anaplastic large cell lymphoma. But also we're interested in looking at it in other settings as well, such as the cutaneous CD30-positive T-cell lymphomas. These are diseases that, again, can recur over and over again, and oftentimes we don't use systemic therapy for these patients. We use local radiation, or we might use an agent like methotrexate. So it's really nice to have a targeted therapy for these patients.
So this compound's sort of a Trojan horse type effect, where it's an antibody that is delivering this toxin to the tumor cell?
Exactly. I think about it as a targeted toxin therapy, where it binds to the receptor, it gets internalized into the cell, and it very specifically only kills those cells that have the CD30 receptor.
Would you say it's analogous? I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, to the agent TDM1 in breast cancer, which is trastuzumab, hooked onto a maytansine derivative?
I think it's pretty similar to that approach. And
it
I think
sounds
it's,
similar.
It's interesting that we're now using these antibodies to target tumors and to introduce cytotoxic molecules, which I think is the way we really need to go.
With the breast cancer drug, they've seen almost no chemotherapy-like side effects. What about with the SGN compound?
SGN has been really well tolerated as well. The side effects are really minimal, and there are a few kind of unusual things that have happened, but by and large, most of the patients have tolerated without major side effects.
Now, if, again, you had seen large cell transformation in this woman, would you have tried to get her on a trial of SGN?
If I had SGN available and she was CD30 positive, I most certainly would have treated her with SGN35, and certainly we'd love to have clinical trials for these patients.
What fraction of large cell disease is CD30 positive?
Usually it's, I'd say, probably over half of the large cell transformations are CD30 positive, but also many of the tumor stage MFs are CD30 positive as well. There are patients out there who haven't converted to tumor stage who can have some CD30 positivity. So I think potentially there's a large number of patients that could benefit from this.
You mentioned combining it with CHOP, but what about just using it by itself?
We're thinking in terms of the anaplastic large cell lymphoma patients, you know, we're thinking about the combination study because most people agree that those patients should have chemotherapy. CHOP is the standard of care for those patients, so that would be the approach.
Has that been sort of looked at in terms of safety at this point?
The combination?
Mm-hmm.
I believe the study that we're doing has a lead-in. It's a dose escalation, so we're going to look at the safety in the first part of the study.
Anything else you want to say? I don't even know whether I should say cutaneous T-cell lymphoma anymore, but about what we've been talking about. Anything new that oncologists are probably, I think oncologists are probably sitting there going, I'm going to refer these patients.
Mm-hmm. When we're talking about anaplastic large cell lymphoma and cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, I just want to make a point, and that is that there is the entity called cutaneous anaplastic large cell lymphoma, which is cutaneous CD30 positive ALCL. This presents usually with skin tumors. It could be one or it could be multiple. And these patients obviously need to have a systemic workup, including a bone marrow biopsy. If they have no systemic disease, the important thing for the practicing physician to know is that those patients should not be treated with CHOP chemotherapy. If you truly have identified a patient who has cutaneous only anaplastic large cell lymphoma, we know that they have a very good outcome. Many of those patients are treated with local radiation. The one pearl to remember about that is that most of the cutaneous only cases are ALK negative. So if you have one that looks cutaneous only and it's ALK positive and you find no systemic involvement, I think you could still approach that patient with local therapy, but you need to have your radar screen up looking for the systemic involvement. So they do need to be carefully restaged.
In terms of ALK-positive disease, oncologists are hearing a lot about crizotinib in non-small cell lung cancer. And I saw there was, two cases reported of patients with ALK-positive large cell reported at ASH. Can you talk about that and where you think that might be headed?
Yeah, we are very interested in looking at the ALK inhibitor in these patients who have ALK-positive ALCL. And we're hoping that we're going to be able to do a clinical trial in that setting.
And these are the only two patients that have been treated? I guess they both responded, huh?
Right. I think the company is interested in lung cancer right now because of the broader population base.
Right. How about your 54-year-old man?
This patient is a 54-year-old male who presented with lymphadenopathy in the axillae, the groin, and extensive pain. He actually presented because he had significant pain in areas where he had lymph nodes, basically in his groin and his axilla, and actually had chest pain. So he presented to his physician who did an exam and found that he had bulky adenopathy. He also, on questioning, had had weight loss and had been having night sweats, but at this time it was over the summer and he wasn't really sure. You know, he didn't identify those as being night sweats per se, but he had had at least a 15-pound weight loss. So he had staging studies which showed extensive adenopathy in multiple areas, and he had a lymph node biopsy that showed an angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma. He also had a bone marrow biopsy that was negative for disease and a PET scan that showed significant PET avidity in multiple nodes, axilli, inguinal area, retroperitoneal, mediastinum, etc.
So before you go into his treatment, maybe we can just take a step back and talk about peripheral T-cell lymphoma in terms of classification and also demographics, and specifically in terms of angioimmunoblastic T-cell disease.
Well, peripheral T-cell lymphoma, again, is a term that encompasses a number of different entities, and I prefer to think about this as the mature T-cell lymphomas. And the T-cell lymphomas comprise about 10 to 12% of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas in the United States, but that's actually about 9,000 cases in the United States. And it's interesting when you think about Hodgkin's disease, which is about 8,500 cases, that there actually are more cases of aggressive T-cell lymphoma. But we really don't know as much about them as we do about Hodgkin's, and we really don't have a clear-cut treatment algorithm.
You use the term mature T-cell lymphoma. What does that mean?
Well, if you look at T-cell lymphomas in the classification system, they basically break them into two groups, the immature and the mature. And the immature is basically the lymphoblastic lymphomas, and the mature T-cell lymphomas are all of the others. And because there are a number of different entities, we pretty much have divided them up based on clinical presentation. So there are four groups. There are the nodal T-cell lymphomas, which are peripheral T-cell lymphoma, NOS, the angioimmunoblastic, anaplastic large cell. And then there are the cutaneous ones, which include mycosis fungoides and CD30 positive lymphomas of the skin, etc. And then there are leukemic ones, which include adult T-cell leukemia associated with HTLV-1, and the NK T-cell leukemias and LGL leukemia. And then there's the other group called the extranodal group, and that's pretty much all the other diseases that don't fit in another group, such as the hepatosplenic and the intestinal T-cell lymphomas and the NK T-cell lymphomas.
So what were the options that you thought through for this man, and what happened?
Well, this patient had an aggressive T-cell lymphoma, and we know that angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma can be a very aggressive disease. This patient is sick. He has B symptoms and extensive adenopathy, and so he's a patient that obviously needs aggressive chemotherapy. But the problem with the aggressive T-cell lymphomas is that if we reflexly reach for CHOP, which we use in aggressive B-cell lymphomas, we know that the outcome isn't as good. And if you look at the retrospective data using CHOP in this setting, although you get about 50% of the patients responding, the median response duration is very short. It's usually in the order of about 6 to 8 months. And so we know CHOP by itself really isn't the most effective therapy. However, we really don't know what's better than CHOP. And I would direct you to the NCCN guidelines, where if you look at the recommendations for first-line therapy for peripheral T-cell lymphomas, you'll see that the first thing on the list is clinical trial. And then all of the different aggressive lymphoma regimens are listed there as well. Now, unfortunately, we did not have a clinical trial that this patient was eligible for. And so I went on and I treated him with EPOC. And he had a very nice remission. After the second cycle, his nodes were significantly decreased, and he's now completing the sixth cycle of therapy.
Why did you choose EPOC as opposed to CHOP?
Well, I'd like to say that there was a good reason for that, but unfortunately, there really is no data out there showing that any aggressive lymphoma regimen is any better than any other one. But because this patient had a very aggressive presentation, and the EPOC regimen does contain etoposide, which we know is an active drug in this setting as well, it is infusional, I felt that this would be a better approach. Now, I could have chosen HyperCVAD, you know, I could have chosen ESHAP, you know, there really is no data yet. And I think that's relevant to what's going on now in the international community, which is that we are trying to get together to really address this question and to look at some alternative upfront regimens for patients like this.
Such as?
We had done a study that recently was completed combining Denileukin Diftitox with CHOP, and we showed that the response rate was very high, but that was a phase 2 single-arm study. And likewise, in Europe, they've combined alemtuzumab with CHOP, and in that setting, you see more toxicity. And so I think it's still an open question as to what is the right combination. But I will say that the Denileukin Diftitox CHOP is going to a multicenter international randomized trial. And in Europe, they are randomizing between alemtuzumab CHOP and CHOP by itself.
You were talking before about romidepsin and pralatrexate. What about those agents?
Those agents have not been used in the front line at this point, but we are looking at ways of combining them to introduce them along with frontline therapy.
How do you think that's going to work from a toxicity point of view?
Well, that's one of the major issues that we're dealing with. And before adding a drug like that to any of these combinations, we need to do phase two studies looking at doublets and then triplets. So I think we're still a couple of years away from knowing what the right combination is.
So what are you thinking in terms of future plans for this man?
We know with angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, as with other aggressive T-cell lymphomas, that none of these patients are cured with chemotherapy. None of these patients stay in remission. And so most of these patients are going to move on to some kind of a consolidative strategy, such as a transplant. If you look again at the NCCN guidelines, the recommendation is to go to an autologous transplant in patients who achieve a complete remission. There are some settings where you might consider an allogeneic transplant, but we know that with angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, there has been a large study from Europe looking at autologous transplant and showing that about 60% of the patients benefited from this approach. And so most of us in the field would feel that autologous transplant is the most appropriate strategy at this point.
Now, this man right now is in a CR?
This man is now in a clinical complete remission.
So what about timing of transplant, and what are you thinking for him?
Well, it's important to move on to transplant as quickly as possible. And so oftentimes we will harvest the stem cells off of the last cycle of chemotherapy, and then we'll get a scan just to make sure that they're in remission, and then we'll move fairly quickly to the transplant.
And that's what you're planning in him?
That's our plan at this point. One other issue I would just mention in this setting is that even in the setting of autologous transplant, under the best of circumstances, you have about 40% of your patients relapsing. And so one of the questions in the field now is whether we ought to use some consolidative or some maintenance therapy after the transplant. And that's a subject of debate, and hopefully we'll have some clinical trials soon.
I guess, has lenalidomide been used in the disease? Because it seems like it's being used as maintenance in a lot of diseases.
Lenalidomide is a very interesting drug and has been shown to have activity in a number of different lymphomas. And there has been some data in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and some limited data in PTCL as well. But we're actually very interested in the drug. And in fact, we are going to be launching a clinical trial combining lenalidomide with romidepsin.
Wow. As what, just in recurrent disease?
The initial trial will be done in patients with relapsed and refractory disease.
Lenalidomide and romidepsin. What about some kind of lenalidomide-romidepsin maintenance after transplant? Or you mentioned maintenance. What kind of maintenance are you thinking about?
When you think about maintenance, obviously there are a number of drugs that are active that one could use, including romidepsin. One could even think about the oral HDAC inhibitor vorinostat. There's denileukin diftatox and pralatrexate. And I think that nobody really knows a priori which of these drugs would be best. And so perhaps a strategy would be to do a trial where you're randomizing patients to one versus the other to see if you could detect whether any of these drugs prolongs the time to treatment failure.
How are we doing about getting these patients on trials? Now we're talking about this specific entity. Are they getting treated in the community or, again, being referred in?
I think that there's more of a tendency now to think about clinical trials for patients with aggressive T-cell lymphoma, and that's, you know, because we now have active drugs. What's been very interesting is that, as you know, we completed two trials in the last couple of years, one of them pralatrexate and the other one just completed with romidepsin. Both of those trials had 100 patients or more. And both of those trials actually accrued very quickly. And I think that speaks to the fact that the community recognizes that this is a tremendous unmet medical need. And so there is an interest in getting these patients on trial.